Hello, I'm Hanea Ahu, bringing you The Week in Parliament with Tom Fruin and Rhys Lyon. Our first programme for 2015 features the parliamentary year's opening debate on the Prime Minister's statement, the first question for ministers and the first bill to be passed. That's the Education Amendment Bill No. 2. More on that later in the programme, but first, a new feature.
The Week in Parliament, Mystery Voice.
The ceremony will be free to attend, with live music and several enormous games of backyard cricket. It's going to be a great ceremony.
Who's speaking and what are they talking about? Here it is again.
The Week in Parliament, Mystery Voice.
The ceremony will be free to attend, with live music and several enormous games of backyard cricket. It's going to be a great ceremony.
Who's speaking and what are they talking about? I'll reveal all of that at the end of the program. No prizes for correct answers, just the satisfaction of knowing you were right. That's a big thing in politics. Now, here's Tom Fruin with a summary of the first week in the House.
The parliamentary year began at 2 p.m. on Tuesday with this announcement from the Speaker, David Carter.
Honourable members, I wish to advise the House that I've received a letter from Mike Sabin, resigning his seat with effect from Friday, 30 January 2014.
Mr. Sabin's resignation creates a vacancy in the Northland electorate and reduces the number of MPs in the House to 120 and his National Party's caucus down from 60 to 59 MPs, sitting on the Treasury benches for a third term, with their leader, John Key, kicking off the opening debate of the year with his Prime Minister's statement and the reference to the mandate they received in last year's election.
And the message was pretty simple. Carry on. Carry on making the country more wealthier. Carry on making this a more vibrant country. Carry on making this a more multicultural, globally connected country. Mr. Speaker, carry on making New Zealand a successful little nation we can all be proud of, Mr. Speaker. That's what they said. And for the third time, the public allowed us to work with our friends at the ACT Party, United Future and the Māori Party.
Who, within hours, had crossed the floor to cast their two votes with the opposition when the government adjourned the debate on the Prime Minister's statement to put the House to work on a couple of bills. The first was the Education Amendment Bill No. 2, which establishes a new regulatory and disciplinary regime for teachers and reduces the size of university councils. Without Mr. Sabin, National had to rely on both ACT and United Future for the two votes now needed for a bare majority of 61, defeating the 59 of all other parties, including the Māori Party, to give the Education Amendment Bill No. 2 a third and final reading. The House then debated the second reading of the Immigration Amendment Bill No. 2, sending it on to the next stage by the same narrow margin, with all opposition parties concerned about its lack of protection for migrant workers. There was more debate on government legislation on Wednesday in the form of three bills in their committee stage. But apart from question time on Thursday, MPs slogged on through the debate on the Prime Minister's statement until its interruption by the adjournment at 6 p.m, with 2 hours and 36 minutes remaining on the order paper for next week, as indicated by the Leader of the House, Jerry Brownlee, in his weekly business statement on Thursday.
When the House resumes on Tuesday, the 17th of February, the government will look to progress the debate on the Prime Minister's statement and a number of pieces of legislation on the order paper, including the Gambling Amendment Bill No. 2, the Parole Amendment Bill, and the Energy, Fuels, Levies and References Amendment Bill.
The debate on the Prime Minister's statement will end in a vote on whether the House should have confidence in Mr. Key's government, a motion quickly amended by Opposition Leader Andrew Little.
I move that all the words after that be deleted and replaced with: this House expressed no confidence in this National-led government because this is a government that has lost its moral compass, turned a blind eye to the deplorable actions of its MPs.
Among them, Mike Sabin, singled out by Mr. Little's police spokesman, Kelvin Davis, in the first question time on Wednesday.
To the Minister of Police, on what date, if any, was the first of any briefings given by the Commissioner of Police or his staff to him, his predecessor, the Prime Minister or any of their officers in relation to the reported investigation into Mike Sabin?
The police minister is Michael Woodhouse, who took shelter behind the only valid reason available to ministers for not answering a question, that it wouldn't be in the public interest.
It's not appropriate, nor in the public interest, for me to discuss details relating to whether I may have received or provided details on a specific police matter.
Opposition questions on the other big topic in the week's two question times, whether the government's deal with the Sky City Casino will require taxpayer funding for building a new convention centre that's not an eyesore, elicited a similar response from the Prime Minister.
The government's preferred position is that Sky City pay for the convention centre at $402 million, but we'll see how that goes.
Also left up in the air was a decision on putting New Zealand troops on the ground in Iraq, despite this announcement from Defence Minister Gerry Brownlee on Tuesday.
I do want to inform the House this afternoon that I have asked the Chief of Defence Forces to begin some preliminary training of troops who may be asked to assist in a building capacity mission in Iraq.
Although Mr Brownlee said this did not preempt a cabinet decision on sending troops, his Prime Minister had clearly made up his mind.
This will be a government that will take seriously its responsibilities when it comes to standing up to ISIS. As I said in Waitangi, I will not, as leader of New Zealand, stand back and see Jordanian pilots burnt to death. I will not see young children beheading soldiers. I will not sit back when people are thrown off buildings because of their sexuality and then be lectured by the left about human rights. They don't care enough about human rights to do something about it. No wonder they're looking down in shame, Mr. Speaker.
Rather than looking down in shame, Opposition Leader Andrew Little was shaking his head in disgust as he responded to Mr. Key's opening statement.
That was typical of this Prime Minister. Nasty, petty, pettifogging, no direction, nothing to offer. He's had two months on the beaches, and he's come back with nothing more to offer.
But the government's response in the debate on the Prime Minister's statement in Question Times was that things could not be better, with ministers rejecting opposition critics, such as Labour's primary production spokesman, Damien O'Connor, who had questions on Thursday about an adverse report on the government's primary growth partnership, or PGP.
What other areas of government funding would allow the spend of $129 million without any identifiable economic benefits, and in the words of the Auditor General, quote, no ability to show what PGP as a whole has achieved, unquote.
With the Minister for Primary Industries away declaring a drought, officially known as a medium-scale adverse event down the east coast of the South Island, Mr O'Connor's questions were answered for him by his associate, Joe Goodhue, who conceded some defects.
The reporting that is currently underway could be made more simple for the average reader in the street, and we have certainly taken that on board. But I remind the member that there are not only detailed websites, quarterly reports, a regular newsletter, an annual expo, presence at the field days, program steering groups, quarterly progress reporting, annual plans and audits to show the public of New Zealand what they will get over the long term.
Joe Goodhue's cabinet colleague Louise Upston also had to stand in for Internal Affairs Minister Peter Dunn to defend changes to the National Library School Lending Service, saying the opposition's claims of cuts were, in fact, improvements.
This is not a cut to the service. This is the ability for the National Library to deliver more information, more books, in more schools that will provide better learning opportunities for more of our children.
Louise Upson was responding to questions from Labour's Jacinda Ardern, who also made this request.
Point of order, Mr Speaker, I seek leave to table a petition of 18,196 New Zealanders calling on Peter Dunn to reverse his cuts to the National Library Curriculum Topic Service.
There's a process for the tabling of petitions in this House.
And that process, as the Speaker was advised by the clerk, does allow for requests for leave to table petitions in the Chamber.
Order. I'm advised by the clerk that leave can be sought to do it in the way the member's asking, so I will put the leave and it's for the House to sign. Leave is sought to table this petition signed by some 18,000 people. Is there any objection to that course of action? There is court objection. Question. Order.
Requests for leave can be vetoed by any one member, but even when a petition is presented, there's nothing to stop it disappearing into the woodwork for a while, as we'll learn in Rhys Lyon's report on the week in the committee rooms.
A change in the chairmanship of the Law and Order Committee on Wednesday saw National's Kanwaljit Singh Bakshi take over the role following the recent resignation from Parliament of the former chair, Mike Sabin. The first item of business for that committee following Mr. Bakshi's appointment was the hearing of submissions on the Policing Cost Recovery Amendment Bill, which will allow the police to charge organisations for background checks or vetting of prospective employees. The bill drew concern from Volunteering New Zealand Chief Executive Vani Sidiru.
Now, the crux of our argument is that the impact of having to vet or charge vetting for volunteers is going to cost significantly to organisations. It's going to add administrative burden, it's going to add time for those volunteer managers to actually do that work, and it's also going to be a detractor for volunteers potentially to volunteer. So that's not what we want to see in our cities and communities.
Meanwhile, New Zealand Council of Christian Social Services Executive Officer Trevor McGlinchey suggested a different approach to police vetting.
The best mechanism would be for government to hold the police accountable for delivering an efficient, effective service. And that would be a more effective mechanism to achieve the outcome desired, to ensure that people working with our children are actually effectively vetted. It seems to me making payments to organisations who then make payments back to government for that service is circular, it's inefficient and creates problems. So I would ask this committee to look for a much more efficient and effective method of ensuring this is funded appropriately.
New Zealand Council of Christian Social Services Executive Officer Trevor McGlinchey with that submission on the Policing Cost Recovery Amendment Bill. Following day, Thursday, and it took almost 4 years, but a petition that was first presented to Parliament by Labour's Marianne Street back in 2011, calling for greater transparency around the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement negotiations, was up before the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee, and the time lag wasn't lost on the petition's sponsor, Council of Trade Unions President Helen Kelly.
So we presented this petition, or Honourable Marianne Street presented it to the Parliament in 2011, and we don't really understand why it's taken 4 years before we've had the opportunity to be heard, and obviously so much has happened in this space in between that petition being presented and today, and we think that makes our calls in that petition even more urgent.
Ms Kelly said time to review the trade agreement was running out.
Heads of government and trade ministers say that the negotiations are now nearing a completion, and we've even been told by the Prime Minister and others that if they're not completed in the next few months, they may never be. And we think that creates this huge pressure on the negotiations, and that pressure creates an increased risk of poor decisions being made.
And Helen Kelly's concerns were echoed by Oxfam policy advisor Luke Rorton.
These concerns are in addition to the threat posed to New Zealand's sovereignty itself. The absolute right for New Zealanders to determine our own futures. The very right New Zealanders expect this Parliament to protect. Yet the TPPA negotiations are being conducted in secret. In fact, parties to the TPPA negotiations agreed not to disclose documents relating to the negotiations until 4 years after the treaty comes into effect. This is why we are asking for an inquiry into the effects of the TPPA before an agreement is signed.
Oxfam policy advisor Luke Rorton speaking to the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee. Elsewhere in the committee rooms on Thursday, the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee heard submissions on a petition calling for mandatory driving tests for foreigners before they can drive in New Zealand. Making a submission on that petition was Automobile Association Policy and Research Manager Simon Douglas.
The AA does not believe that a practical test at the border for visitors is pragmatic or practical. We just don't believe that it'll be able to be implemented or make a difference.
Meanwhile, Tourism Industry Association Chief Executive Chris Roberts pointed to another problem with the petition's proposal.
Our law enshrines the international conventions that we've signed up to. That allows all overseas drivers who've got a current licence to drive here for up to 12 months from their date of arrival, and we get the same recognition overseas. So if we were to create any barriers, it potentially creates an impact on us when we travel overseas. So we're strongly of the view that rather than being tested, visiting drivers need to be provided with relevant and accurate and timely information about driving in New Zealand.
Tourism Industry Association Chief Executive Chris Roberts speaking to the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee. All up, there were 16 committee meetings held during the week.
That report from Rhys Lyon. Now back to the debating chamber with Tom Frewin and a report on the only bill to be passed during the week.
The government moved to interrupt the debate on the Prime Minister's statement before the dinner break on Thursday to put the Education Amendment Bill No. 2 through its third and final reading. The bill sets up a new regulatory regime for teachers, replacing the New Zealand Teachers' Council with a new body called the Education Council of Aotearoa New Zealand, a 100% increase in the length of its name, which has already been conveniently shortened to EDUCANS. The bill also reduces the size of the councils that govern universities. Its passage through the House has been closely contested, supported only by National, United Future and ACT. They gave the government 62 votes to defeat the opposition's 59 on the bill's second reading last year. But without National's Northland MP Mike Sabin, the government's majority was going to be down by one for the third reading, for which the debate was launched by the Minister of Education, Hekia Parata.
This is an important bill for the education sector, system and profession. The bill strengthens the education profession by establishing a new professional body for teachers. It both clarifies and strengthens the regulatory framework and the disciplinary regime for the teaching profession, modernises governance arrangements for universities and wānanga, establishes a legal framework for the code of practice for the pastoral care of international students, establishes an independent contract disputes resolution scheme for international students and their education providers, and strengthens quality assurance arrangements in the tertiary education sector.
The opposition's response to Hekia Parata was led off after the dinner break by Labor's education spokesman, Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, the Education Amendment Bill No. 2 represents a hugely wasted opportunity to make some changes that would genuinely increase the quality of teaching in New Zealand and genuinely lead to better outcomes for New Zealand students. The review of the Teachers' Council was welcomed by the whole profession. There was nobody in the teaching profession that thought that things that were going swimmingly well and that there wasn't room for improvement. Everybody that I have spoken to in the teaching profession believes that there is a significant role for a regulatory body like the Teachers Council to set the standards of entry into the teaching profession, to review manage the registration and renewal of practising certificates, and to manage the competency and disciplinary functions that the council should have. Everybody accepts that there is a role for that body, and the teaching profession want to ensure that it is a quality body that will genuinely be owned and driven by the profession.
But Chris Hipkins said the bill was flawed from the outset.
Because it simply removes the autonomy of that whole teaching profession away and gives the complete control of the regulation of the profession to the government. All of the appointees on the Council of the Education Council of Aotearoa New Zealand, or EDUCANS, will be selected by the minister. And what other profession that we genuinely believe is a profession and that we genuinely respect the autonomy of, would we do that to? We don't do it to lawyers, to doctors, to engineers, don't even do it to real estate agents, and yet the government seem to think that they can take complete control of the profession.
Labor's Chris Hipkins was joined in opposition to the Education Amendment Bill No. 2 by the Greens' Catherine Delahunty.
Mr. Speaker, ostensibly this is about tidying up the governance of universities and making the Teachers' Council into a more effective body. Although how this is achieved by changing the names, confusing the functions, cutting the representation and annoying enormous numbers of teachers and educational professionals is anybody's guess. In 6 years of being on the Select Committee, I have never seen so much unity and solidarity from all parts of the tertiary education sector against this bill, and so little even attempt to explain why it is needed by the government. Quaint idea, a bill should have a reason. If they're going to gut the governance structures of universities, they should at least have the intestinal fortitude to explain why this is necessary.
On hand to respond to Catherine Delahunty's request for an explanation was the Minister for Tertiary Education, Stephen Joyce.
Mr Speaker, I want to focus on the areas of the bill that are related to my role as Tertiary Education, Skills and Employment Minister. The changes proposed are the latest in a series of reforms made by this government to improve the performance and quality of tertiary education in this country. We have reduced spending in low-value areas, such as student loans for people who consistently fail their courses, and we've improved the way the system targets need. We've set performance incentives on providers and students and improved information for students about the performance of providers and the outcomes of their study. And our approach is paying off, Mr Speaker. The tertiary system delivered a record number of qualifications in 2013. Also that year, 26,200 bachelor degrees were completed by domestic students, just over 4,500 since 2010. Right through the 2000s, the number of degree graduates flatlined despite big increases in tertiary funding by the previous government, so these results are great to see. We're also in the process of improving outcomes for Māori and Pacifica students. The number of Māori students enrolled in qualifications at bachelor's level or higher increased from 17,500 in 2007 to 22,100 in 2013. And the number of Pacifica students enrolled in qualifications at bachelor's level or higher has increased from 8,570 in 2007 to 12,600 in 2013. There is more work to do, but the direction is positive. The changes to university and Wānanga governance proposed in this bill builds on these gains. There are four major changes from the current model. Firstly, councils will decrease in size from 12 to 20 members to 8 to 12 members. Universities and Wānanga will choose their council size within those limits. Secondly, council membership requirements will be made more flexible by the removal of specific representative requirements. Thirdly, the Minister and councils will be required to appoint members with relevant knowledge, skills or experience. And fourthly, the duties and accountabilities of individual council members will be clarified, including the circumstances in which a member may be dismissed. All university and Wānanga councils will be required to have at least one Māori member to assist the government's goal of raising achievement for Māori. And I would note that that would not involve significant change to current arrangements.
Back across the chamber, the New Zealand First Party's Tracy Martin rose to the defence of the professionalism of the teaching profession.
The code of conduct alterations inside this bill is, we believe, a knee-jerk reaction to what is a mistaken belief out there that has been encouraged, assisted, helped along by the National Party to shift across their program of privatisation and distrust of the public education system, that you can't get rid of a teacher. I went to Vanguard Military School because I have an open mind. And unlike what some people might accuse us of, New Zealand First is open to having a look at things, seeing whether they work for children and for New Zealanders, so we go and have a look. And I went to Vanguard. And it was very interesting. The haka that was put on by the children, lovely haka. I don't know what you call the gentleman. I don't think he's a principal. I think he's a general manager. He said to me as we walked away, you'd never be able to get a full school haka at a public school. And I said to him, oh, how funny. There's 1,500 children at Maharangi College who can do their own school haka. They don't have to borrow it off Ngāti Whātua. And then we went to his office and he said, oh, but you can't get rid of teachers. Can't get rid of teachers. And that's what Mr Seymour thinks too. That's why Mr Seymour and that insidious little voice that he has that starts to push education policy through the National Party, he believes also that you can't get rid of teachers in this country. But we have appraisal process, we have competency, we have laws of natural justice, but the code of conduct, you have a listen to what it says inside of here. The code of conduct is specifically there. Here you go. This is from the revised departmental report, July 2014. The lack of a code of conduct could make employers' assessment of professional conduct arbitrary and problematic. That's actually a really nice way to say, if we want to get rid of you, we want to get rid of you now. If we don't like one thing or something about what you're doing in your classroom, or if you stand up against us because you're standing up for that child because you believe that that child shouldn't be ostracised or excluded or whatever, whatever, and we don't like it, you will have broken the code of conduct and we will fire you. That's what this is about. This is about making sure that teachers do as they're told. That's what this is about.
The New Zealand First Party's Tracy Martin. The third reading debate on the Education Amendment Bill No. 2 saw the bill sent off for the Governor-General's signature by 61 votes to 59, opposed by all other parties except National Act and United Future.
Thanks, Tom. And as we heard from Gerry Brownlee, the government hopes to make more progress on legislation this week. With the debate on the Prime Minister's statement out of the way, the House can get back to its weekly routine of having a general debate on Wednesday.
Yes, if the debate on the Prime Minister's statement ends on Tuesday, there can be a general debate on Wednesday, and then we're back into the normal cycle, which means that every second week there's a Members' Day, and that looks likely to happen on Wednesday week. Labour's chief whip made a point of asking Gerry Brownlee about that after his business statement on Thursday last.
Can I just check with the Leader of the House that it's his intention or his expectation that there'll be a Members' Day the week after next?
Honourable Gerry Brownlee, Mr Speaker, unless there are some unforeseen circumstances, that is the plan.
The Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee. And I can now reveal that the mystery voice belongs to one of his Cabinet colleagues, Jonathan Coleman.
The Week in Parliament Mystery Voice.
The ceremony will be free to attend with live music and several enormous games of backyard cricket. It's going to be a great ceremony.
Jonathan Coleman is the Minister of Health, but he is also the Minister for Sport and Recreation. So, of course, he was talking there about the Cricket World Cup. Now, finally, Tom, any more highlights from the debating chamber?
On Wednesday, in the first question time, there were a number of questions for the Prime Minister asking him if he stood by all his previous statements, and one of them was this one from Winston Peters, New Zealand First Leader.
Does he stand by all his statements?
What? Right, Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, yes, especially that one when I said yesterday there's no dying these locks, baby.
Have any question?
Order, supplementary question, Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Well, how come the curtains don't match the carpet?
Order. Mr. Speaker, I take offence that the member is telling New Zealand he's seen my carpet.
No, I just mean the sideboards.
Okay. Order. Order.
You can find lots more information and a podcast of this program on our webpage, parliamenttoday.co.nz. I'm Hinea Ahu, and I'll be back at the same time with Tom Frewen and Rhys Lyon and another report on the week in Parliament.